From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, filling in for Terry Gross. Garden State, the popular film about being 20-something and adrift, is now out on DVD. On today's Fresh Air, Zach Braff, who wrote, directed, and starred in it. He also stars in Scrubs. We'll talk with Braff and the executive producer of Scrubs, Bill Lawrence. Also, parenthood, suburbia, and the feeling you're living the wrong life. Tom Parada talks about his novel Little Children, now out in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Head On, the German film about a Turkish couple in Hamburg who marry out of convenience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Zach Braff, who stars in the NBC medical sitcom Scrubs, has found it easier to get noticed off TV than on it. His first effort as a filmmaker, as both director and star, was the well-received Garden State, recently released on DVD. The movie was a surprise hit at the Sundance Film Festival, got very good reviews from critics, and generated excellent business for an independent film. Braff plays Andrew Largeman, a young man coming home to his New Jersey birthplace to attend the funeral of his mother. In this scene, he's talking with his soon-to-be girlfriend, played by Natalie Portman. They're sitting in a pool.
You know that point in your life when you realize the house you grew up in isn't really your home anymore? All of a sudden, even though you have some place where you put your that idea of home is gone.
Still feel at home in my house.
You'll see one day when you move out, it just sort of happens one day and it's gone. You feel like you can never get it back. It's like you feel homesick for a place that doesn't even exist. But maybe it's like this rite of passage, you know? You won't ever have that feeling again until you create a new idea of home for yourself, you know, for your kids, for the family you start. It's like a cycle or something. I don't know, but I miss the idea of it, you know? Maybe that's all a family really is. A group of people that miss the same imaginary place.
Zach Braff also stars in Scrubs, an NBC series that began in 2001. Like Garden State, it was met with critical acclaim for its offbeat and often dark humor and sensibilities. Unlike Garden State, it has never really prospered. NBC's moved it all over the schedule and shelved it recently until just a few weeks ago, when new episodes began to appear, featuring such guest stars as Colin Farrell. Today on Fresh Air, we'll talk with Garden State director, writer, and star Zach Braff, and with the creator of Scrubs, TV writer-producer Bill Lawrence. On Scrubs, Zach Braff stars as J.D. Dorian. He was a first-year resident as the series began, but now has made it all the way to chief resident. Well, co-chief resident, anyway. Braff has been acting since his teens and got his first big break playing Woody Allen's son in Manhattan Murder Mystery. Garden State, released last year, marked his official debut as a filmmaker. Bill Lawrence was on the writing staff of Friends, then co-created the sitcom Spin City with Gary David Goldberg. He created Scrubs 4 years ago, when it was hailed as the first new NBC sitcom since Friends to bring any quality to Thursday nights. In addition to Zach Braff as J.D., the ensemble cast of characters in Scrubs includes Donald Faison as Turk, J.D.'s fellow resident and best friend, Sarah Chalk as Elliot, J.D.'s former lover and current co-chief resident, and John C. McGinley as Dr. Cox, the hospital's authority figure who speaks very fast and very meanly to all the residents. Here's a scene from earlier this season, in which J.D., seeking help in inspiring the new first-year residents under his wing, makes the mistake of asking the dreaded Dr. Cox to give them a pep talk.
Ooh, Dr. Cox, can I ask you something?
The answer is yes, it was me who saw you doing leg lifts in the gym on that inflatable ball. It was quite the display of girl power. Absolutely loved the leg warmers.
First of all, they were just big socks, okay? And secondly, if you need to do some laundry, here's the washboard, right?
What do you want?
As co-chief resident, I've noticed that some of my residents are a little overwhelmed. I think it would be nice if you gave them one of your patented pep talks, you know?
I'll be more than glad to give your residents a little pep talk.
Each and every one of you is going to kill a patient. At some point during your residency, you will screw up, they will die, and it will be burned into your conscience forever. Hell, take Pee Pants here.
Pee Pants.
He just might go ahead and get himself a good clean kill this morning, seeing as his patient, Miss Sampson, is in DKA and he hasn't been tracking her phosphate level, her phosphate level, her phosphate level.
Doug! Stop writing and go!
That young man has killed so many patients, I'm starting to think he just might be a government operative. The point is, the harder you study, the longer you just might be able to hold off that first kill. Other than that, I guess, cross your fingers and hope that the guy you murder is a jackass with no family. Great to see you, kids. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Cox.
I spoke with Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence last year when they had resumed production on the current season of their sitcom and asked Lawrence why he cast Braff in Scrubs.
No, Zach is a ridiculously talented actor, and one of the things I was trying to do with the show Scrubs was try to find a way to, in a show, have it cover both dramatic elements and big, broad, silly comedy. And Zach was an actor that had the ability to make the transition between the two very quickly and still have the audience believe it. And besides that, I'm a huge fan of physical comedy. And one of the things that I saw early on in Zach that we were really excited to do was that he has the same physicality that John Ritter had in his ability to turn jokes and pratfalls and make them truly look out of the ordinary. I mean, I'm a lucky guy that the two male leads that I worked with so far on my television shows were Mike Fox and Zach Braff, and I think they're two the best television physical comedians out there. And the other reason that I was really interested in Zach was the character on the show early on Scrubs is playing a young resident at his first day of work at a hospital, and how he's in completely over his head and has all this responsibility. And I thought that a really cool metaphor for that was hiring an actor that didn't have a whole lot of credits and were basically going through the same thing in their real life, which is to be expected to carry an ensemble show from the outset, having never really had this big break before. And one of the things I think was cool was that, Zach's, vulnerability and, in turn, the empathy we felt for him as an audience showed through in his early performances, partly because of his talent and partly because he was going through the same experience in real life.
And Zach, what do you remember about the audition process once you got to L.A. and got in front of those executives?
I was very, very nervous. I actually auditioned a total of six times for Scrubs. The first time was this time where I was put on tape, and I didn't think I did a very good job at all. And when I got out to L.A., I was able to work with Bill, and it got better. And I think, the process of auditioning for a comedic pilot is so grueling, because you walk into this room, and pretty much every time I've ever done it, nobody laughs. This was the first time where Bill was really helpful and, really went out of his way to make me and the other people auditioning feel comfortable before we were supposed to go into this really funny scene. And then people in the room were genuinely laughing, which is helpful, because if I've gone to these auditions where you're doing these scenes and they're supposed to be really funny and no one makes a sound. So
that must be brutal.
It's terrifying.
It's a horrifying experience.
I mean, it really is. It's like the Olympics in a way, that because you can, I went in six times, and you can go in five times and really do an amazing job. But on the final audition in front of the network, which is, 35 people in a very small room, if you don't really land it and do it right that time, then it doesn't really matter.
Talk about the inspiration for Scrubs.
You know what the greatest thing about this show is Spin City. When I created Spin City, I knew nothing about that world at all, and really we were just doing a traditional multi-camera sitcom. And the best thing about this show, and the reason I was somewhat protective of it, is it's hard for people to believe, but it was truly real. It's my best friend from college, whose name is JD and is now a cardiologist in the Los Angeles area and the medical advisor on the show, he and two other of my buddies went to med school. And I think everybody has a group of friends that your frame of reference is when you're a teenager. So when you think of these people and when you see them, you regress. And, and my last memory of JD is of a guy, with an empty 12-pack of beer on his head. And and now, I always used to joke that my worst nightmare in the world as a young 23-year-old would be to wake up in an emergency room and see JD over me going, "You're going to be fine. Don't even worry about it." But as I was sitting with these guys and, just basically drinking a beer and talking, the one through line they all had was how horrifying their internship and residency were. And each one of them just said to me, everybody can imagine that job they had, that first day of work, and how scared you were and how you felt like you were going to fail and that everybody was judging you. And they said, add to that that you're suddenly responsible for the well-being of other human beings and whether or not they're going to live and die, and you would not believe, how all-encompassing and how incredibly horrifying an experience it is. And just that to me stuck something in my head, that it would be an amazing TV show. And I've actually been able to, just through those two guys and actually a girl, which would be a title for another TV show. The there would be
for about a year and a half.
Yeah, exactly. Just through those three, and through the extension of other doctors, we have not done one medical story or even medical moment on the show that wasn't handed to us by another physician. That's the, you know, we've been embraced by the medical community. It's been one of the best things for us. And a deal that we have out there is that anytime doctors give us stories, you know, we end up naming characters after them and promising not to use real names of patients or anything like that. But, I mean, as a result of this show, you know, the real JD was the keynote speaker at Brown's med school graduation. I was I spoke at USC's med school graduation. Doctors are the most supportive group that we have. But, yeah, all that stuff's real. And to me, once I talked to all these doctors, as far as how the show came to be, I knew right away that it wouldn't be hard coming up with the funny stuff. And not only did I think it would be a great TV show, but to me, it made doctors seem very human. And on television, that's not something that in the dramas, people don't really do that, I don't think. I think they make them seem so bigger than life and so heroic. And all my friends that are doctors are still goofy, funny guys just trying to get through their day.
The interracial relationship between J.D. and Turk on the show is probably, to me, the most easygoing, convincing, and nice one, probably since all the way back to I Spy. Do you,
it's cool.
Do you take it seriously? I mean,
I take it incredibly seriously. I was a horrible, horrible stand-up comic when I was really young, and one of the things I always try to talk about was I was a TV kid, and every TV show that I watched in my childhood, and I'm not that old, whenever there was a black guy and a white guy hanging out together, it would be a special episode. You know? Oh, my God, Jimmy's got a black friend. What the hell is going on?
On a very special silver spoon.
Or they would err on the other side, which is, you know, there'd be a black friend and a white friend that hang out and are really close, but miraculously never notice that the other is black and that the other is white. And I, you know, hey, I don't want to trump myself up here, David, but I've had some black friends. No, but basically one of the cool things is my buddies that we're comfortable with, and, you know, both ways, we would always – one of the funniest things about that those kinds of friendships are just the observations you get to make about whether or not somebody – slides into a stereotype or tweaking, you know, the societal things that people say, and not shying away from it and being comfortable enough with a buddy that you can truly talk about it and shine a light on those things. And it's the aspect of their relationship that we take the most seriously, because we always want to be funny, but we never want to go over to the other side of oh, now you're just using the fact that he's black and he's white to make a kind of a racially edgy joke. It's more important to us that these guys are so tight that they can they can cross lines and they can say things. And to me, it's the way that those relationships should be. But I'm really flattered that you asked, because it's something that we pay so much attention to in the writers' room, and we think nobody ever notices.
And that's true in real life too. I mean, Donald and I, as I said, are really good friends, and there's nothing in the world that I couldn't say in front of him and he me. And there's something refreshing about that, about a friendship where all the people who are so PC, especially on television, two characters that just take that apart, and JD, who's a little more naive, asking Turk questions. I mean, in the pilot, there was a thing about him asking about, you know, what he's supposed to do when there's a rap song on and he's lip syncing along and the N-word comes up, and just sort of deconstructing things about and political correctness. And I think that's refreshing in a way that you don't see on other TV shows.
And one of the amazing things for us is that Zach and Donald became so tight in real life that I don't just have to draw off of my relationships from my past. And I mean, in fact, there's a show that that JD calls, he tries to give Turk the new nickname. I think it was Chocolate Bear.
Yeah.
And it was just something that and Turk on the show likes it. And yeah, that was something that it was a true moment in our show that Zach said it jokingly to Donald, and Donald was laughing, and I was just observing these two guys that were buddies, and there wasn't any edge, and there wasn't any oh my god, you know, and it wasn't even something they stopped for. So,
don't recommend you white friends with
don't
your
try
black
this
friend.
At home.
Don't try this.
Don't necessarily do it to a stranger either.
Don't recommend going into work tomorrow and calling your black friend Chocolate Bear. But it was an example of something that, you know, me and Donald, and then he called me Vanilla Wafer. You know, it was just like a, it was just sort of us joking around. And because it was real, it was something we could put on the show.
My guests from the TV show Scrubs are actor Zach Braff and executive producer Bill Lawrence. Here's a short scene from Scrubs.
Let me buy you lunch.
I'm rich. I'll buy you lunch and some gold teeth to eat it with.
You know, you only got one more black joke this month before I bust your ass.
Damn it. I used them all up watching Barbershop 9.
Okay, that's it, and I'll get you later.
Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence, the star and creator, respectively, of the NBC sitcom Scrubs. Braff also is the star, writer, and director of the movie Garden State, recently released on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our conversation with Zach Braff and Bill Lawrence. I asked Zach Braff about his film Garden State and how long he'd been working on it.
I went to film school. I set out to make movies, and when I graduated, I moved to New York, and I was doing sort of all sorts of odd jobs, and I started auditioning as well. And that's when I started to get work in theater and independent film, and that eventually led me out to L.A. and to audition for Scrubs. But my initial intention when I went to school was to be a filmmaker. So I had made a bunch of short films and had pieces of screenplays. And what happened was I got cast in Scrubs, and that day I quit my waiting tables job. And I was so thrilled and screaming to all my relatives and quit that night. And they called me the next day and said we weren't gonna start shooting Scrubs for 4 months. So I figured out a way to live on any of the money I'd saved, and I sat down and really hammered out what would be the first draft of Garden State in those intervening 4 months.
The music on the soundtrack, I imagine mm-hmm. that was an awful lot of fun to make those choices, was it?
It was. I really compiled a CD of music that I really love. It actually does relate to Scrubs as well, because on the show, Bill and the writers are always looking for new music for the show. And I always like trying to find new bands, and I have a lot of friends who are musicians. So it's fun because I pitch music ideas to Bill for Scrubs as well. And in writing Garden State, I had lots of ideas for the music I wanted in the movie, and I compiled this CD that I gave out to when I was pitching the script around town and said, and this would be, you know, the ideal soundtrack.
And did you have to take any off because the rights were too expensive?
They were all too expensive at first, but then when we showed them, showed people like Coldplay and Simon and Garfunkel the scenes in which they were used, they really responded to it and were generous enough to let us use their music at a rate we could afford, which was pretty much nothing.
And my last question, which I saved till last only because I'm so embarrassed by it, all the care that you guys put into the fantasy sequences, there was one probably from a couple of seasons ago now. Do you know which one
No, I'm just anticipating that it's going to be one of the odd ones.
It is one of the odd ones, and it was one of the characters, and I believe in my memory it was Turk who was fantasizing about Sarah Chalk's character. Mm-hmm. In like a sort of a softcore porn nurse's uniform
nurse's outfit.
Set
sure.
up.
How's it going?
And I remember this 2 years later, partly because
it was hot.
It was for a regular family sitcom. It was like, wow, that whole thing was filmed and shot and performed in a way that I couldn't believe that you got away with on network TV. And I figure there must be a story there.
No, you know what? The only story truly, David, is that by working in a creepy, deserted hospital, we've created this environment that the network people don't want to come and visit us. they honestly, because when they drop by there, it's just hot and muggy and no one's ever around. So we basically just shoot the stuff and try to really approach the line as much as we can. Like, we shot some romance scenes or sex scenes with Zach and Sarah Chalk over the years that I thought were, you know, at least PG-13, if not R-rated movie stuff.
I couldn't believe that someone that got on the air.
I know. And basically, we just turn it in at the last second and say, this is all we got. And they're just nice enough to go with it. And these things all lend themselves to the stories of me talking to the various censors and saying, no, it'll be totally tastefully done. Or, in fact, one of my cherished possessions, David, is they don't, you know, we language is always a tough barrier, especially when you're talking about network television versus cable, because cable, they swear and curse. And I think on network TV, you're allowed to say the word ass, but we had said it too many times in one episode. And the censor had sent me a note that I have framed on my wall that she wanted me to not use it 6 times, but to use it 3 times. So the note said, it listed all the page numbers that the word ass was on, and then the note said, please pick your ass. and I guarantee you that she had no idea of the comedy of it, but it's framed on my wall in my office.
Well, that's Bill awesome. Lawrence, Zach Braff, thank you for coming to Fresh Air.
Hey, thanks for having
us,
man.
Thank you.
Bill Lawrence and Zach Braff. Lawrence is the creator and executive producer of NBC's Scrubs. Zach is the show's star, as well as the star, writer, and director of the movie Garden State, now out on DVD. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring the AARP Crash Course in Estate Planning, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Villa of Mysteries, a novel of suspense set in modern-day Rome by David Hewson, author of A Season for the Dead. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
When his kids were young, Tom Perata was one of the dads at the playground. Coming up, we talk with Perata. His satirical novel Little Children, about parenthood in suburbia, is now out in paperback. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Head On, a German film about a Turkish couple's marriage of convenience. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Little Children is a satirical novel about a young woman who is married, raising her child in an upper-middle-class suburb, and can't understand how she wound up in the life she's living. But she believes she has found some meaning in her life when she meets Todd, a father at the playground who seems to be as alienated as she is. They begin an affair and think they are falling in love. The New York Times Book Review described Little Children as an extraordinary novel about adultery and child raising in a generic American suburb. The author of Little Children is Tom Perata, who also wrote Election, a satirical novel about a high school election. That book was adapted into a film starring Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. Parada's novel The Wishbones was about a musician who wants to be a rock star, but after many years, remains stuck playing weddings. Terry spoke with Tom Parada last spring when Little Children was published. It's just come out in paperback. Here's a reading from the beginning of the novel.
The young mothers were telling each other how tired they were. This was one of their favorite topics, along with the eating, sleeping, and defecating habits of their offspring, the merits of certain local nursery schools, and the difficulty of sticking to an exercise routine. Smiling politely to mask a familiar feeling of desperation, Sarah reminded herself to think like an anthropologist. I'm a researcher studying the behavior of boring suburban women. I am not a boring suburban woman myself. Jerry and I started watching that Jim Carrey movie the other night. This was Cheryl, mother of Christian, a husky 3.5-year-old who swaggered around the playground like a mafia chieftain, shooting the younger children with any object that could plausibly stand in as a gun, a straw, a half-eaten banana, even a Barbie doll that had been abandoned in the sandbox. Sarah despised the boy and found it hard to look his mother in the eye. "The pet guy?" inquired Marianne, mother of Troy and Isabel. "I don't get it. Since when did passing gas become so hilarious?" Only since there was human life on Earth, Sarah thought, wishing she had the guts to say it out loud. Marianne was one of those depressing supermoms, a tiny, elaborately made-up woman who dressed in spandex workout clothes, drove an SUV the size of a UPS van, and listened to conservative talk radio all day. No matter how many hints Sarah dropped to the contrary, Marianne refused to believe that any of the other mothers thought any less of Rush Limbaugh or any more of Hillary Clinton than she did. Every day, Sarah came to the playground determined to set her straight, and every day she chickened out.
That's Tom Parada reading from his new novel, Little Children. Tom, the main characters in this novel are kind of living the wrong life. Like Sarah, the main character who you were just reading about. This is not the life she wanted. She didn't plan on being a mother living in the suburbs. In college, she had been bisexual. She had an affair with a woman. She was immersed in critical gender studies. She worked at a rape crisis hotline. She was hoping to be a feminist film critic. I think a lot of people feel that they ended up in the wrong life. How did she get there?
Well, I think she got there the way a lot of people get where they end up. The years after college were particularly lonely for her. She was directionless. She tried graduate school, was very excited for a while, but then didn't like teaching very much, worked at Starbucks, had some affairs. And somehow there was a man at Starbucks, an older guy who was also a little bit lost, who found his way toward her. And, you know, they fell in love, so she thought, got married, and suddenly found herself in the exact, I mean, she didn't have a profession. He did. Basically, you know, there's a kind of economic determinism to it that's almost 19th century to her. I also think there's something about the generation, that's my generation, the people who went to college in the 80s and 90s, when feminism was still, I think, a really dynamic force in American culture. And you know, we, in our minds, imagined a whole different set of social arrangements and family arrangements, and something happened, you know. I mean, when I was first a parent and at the playground, I was suddenly surprised to find myself often the only stay-at-home dad. I wasn't a full-time stay-at-home dad, but I was doing about half-time childcare, and if I took my kids to the playground during the workday, I was usually the only man there. And I think that in the same way that I probably felt surprised by that and a little bit, like what had happened? What? Where was the world that we thought we were entering? I think someone like Sarah, who was, you know, really in the vanguard of this sort of thinking, probably felt it quite a bit more acutely than I did.
Well, I want to get back in a minute to you being the only dad in the playground, but first I want to talk about another father, a father in your novel, who is the father in the playground. He's one of the few guys who goes there with his kids, with his kid, and he ends up having an affair with Sarah. But he, too, feels like he's not quite in the right life. His thing when he was in college was football, and now he's studying for the bar exam, kind of unenthusiastically. How did he get stuck in the wrong life?
Well, he's not sure about that. His mother died when he was in high school, and he'd become a sort of high achiever in the wake of that, and life had been completely effortless for him through. He's a very good-looking guy, very smart guy. He married this beautiful woman. He got accepted into law school. And at some point, between finishing law school and passing the bar, you know, they had a kid. His wife was working full-time. He was home with the kid. And it, what seemed to happen to Todd was that he just lost interest in the adult trajectory that he'd been on. I mean, in some ways, he's a male version of one of those women CEOs who suddenly decides that she doesn't want to, you know, run the company. She wants to be home with her kids. In some sense, parenthood does appeal to him. I mean, in a way, his wrong life is the exact opposite wrong life of Sarah's. I mean, he's a man who's supposed to have a high-powered career who somehow has decided he likes the rhythms of being home with a kid all day and likes the rhythms of adolescence, likes the rhythms of sports. He likes everything but the rhythms of responsible adulthood.
Do you feel like you're living the right life?
I feel like I am now. I think that I was one of those people who was very shaken by parenthood. Not so much because I didn't like it, because I really did enjoy it, and I found it kind of thrilling and mesmerizing the way a lot of people of my generation, you know, do. At the same time, I wasn't where I wanted to be professionally, and you know, I was shocked by the time burdens that were placed on me, and you know, I had gone to great lengths to, you know, invent myself as somebody who, you know, had a certain level of coolness, or so I thought, you know, and I think parenthood is about the least cool role you can take on, and so for anybody who has any sort of, I think, you know, bohemian leanings or aspirations or self-delusions, you know, you can put it in all those ways. Parenthood is a jolt to, you know, the very fiber of your being.
I'm sure that's true. And why is that? What is it that is so, like, uncool about parenthood, unhip about parenthood?
Well, for one thing, right, coolness must have something to do with a kind of, I mean, there's a certain sexual component to it. And as a parent, you know, your sexuality is, I think, you know, for good reasons, you know, it goes on the back burner, you know, probably even at home, but certainly in a kind of public way. But then it's, you know, you have to argue, you have to argue with your kids, you have to, you know, try and mollify them when they're screaming, you have to walk around with, you know, vomit on your shirt. In fact, you know, one of the roots of this novel was a strange event that happened to me when my daughter was very young, and I used to carry her around in a backpack, which I really enjoyed. But one night I was out for a walk with her, and this guy was a teenager, just started taunting me from a doorway. He just would call me, you know, say, hey, you look like an idiot or something like that. And I remember getting, like, you know, oddly enraged and sort of forgetting for a second that I had my daughter on my back. And, you know, I turned and I said, you know, who are you talking to? And, you know, we had this sort of odd, heated exchange, which is not something that's common in my life. And at a certain point, he just started laughing. He said, what are you going to do, fight me with that thing on your back? You know, that thing on my back being my daughter.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, what's the matter with me? Why am I acting like a, you know, an angry 16-year-old when I'm, you know, 30 years old and I have a small child on my back? And it was just a moment that really stuck with me. And about 10 years ago, I tried to write a story that was called This Thing on My Back, that was about, you know, somebody kind of very reluctant, well, it's not even reluctantly, just somebody finding out that his, you know, adolescent identity was still burning inside of him while he was, you know, a responsible adult with a child to care for.
Tom Parada speaking with Terry Gross. His novel Little Children has just come out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Tom Perata. His novel, Little Children, is a satire about marriage and parenthood in the suburbs. It's just come out in paperback.
How old are your children now?
My daughter's 10, and my son is 7.
In the acknowledgments to your new novel, Little Children, you end it by saying, "Mainly, though, I'd like to thank Nina and Luke for letting me tag along at the playground." So I assume that Nina and Luke are your children, and that you spent a lot of time taking them to the playground and using that as inadvertent research for your novel. You have a really funny paragraph about what the few men who come to the playground with their children are like, what they look like, and how they behave. I'm going to ask you to read that paragraph for us from Little Children.
Okay. Most of the men who showed up at the playground during the workday were marginal types, middle-aged trolls with beards and pot bellies, studiously whimsical academics who insisted on going down the slide with their kids, pinch-hitting grandfathers providing emergency daycare, sheepish blue-collar guys who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes, the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule.
Were you the occasional cooler-than-thou hipster with a flexible schedule?
I was somewhere between the hipster with a flexible schedule and the studiously whimsical academic. But there was some part of me that was also a sheepish blue-collar guy who wouldn't meet anyone's eyes.
All right. What was it like to be one of the few fathers regularly at the playground with your children?
Some women who were at the playground would deny this, but I was actually, made to feel somewhat unwelcome. There was just some sense of, you know, what is he doing here? And if you try to strike up a conversation, sometimes there was a little bit of reserve or coolness. But what did happen, and I think is something I tried to use in the novel, was that occasionally there would be a woman who, for some other reason, was not part of, you know, the sort of the core female society of the core mother group of the playground, and occasionally I would get into conversations with these women who, for whatever reasons, were also outsiders, and that's the dynamic I think between Todd and Sarah. They both feel somehow excluded from this core maternal clique at the playground, and it creates a kind of instant bond of intimacy between them.
There's a section in which Sarah goes shopping for a bathing suit, and she wants to get a bathing suit that makes her look really attractive, which was difficult. And I think most women agree that buying a good bathing suit is a real challenge, and it's something a lot of women are particularly self-conscious about. What kind of thinking did you do to try to write that scene from a woman's perspective?
For men, it's very interesting. You know, the point where you realize how you know nervous and anxious women get about these things. Because of course, for most men, I think the idea of a woman in a bathing suit is you know, kind of a very exciting thing. And the fact is, women are probably much harder on themselves and their bodies than men are at a certain point. So I think that, again, it seems like a pretty pervasive thing. I mean, I read some catalogs, you know, and for instance, if you read, you know, the Land's End catalog, there's a very kind of, you know, the voice of the catalog is, you know, this is coverage, this is going to, you know, save you from certain embarrassing issues that will conceal the problem areas. I mean, it was really just right there in the forefront, and maybe, you know, what I was reading something that men don't normally pay attention to. You know, we're just supposed to look at the pictures. But it was, you know, right out in the front. You know, and I've certainly heard women, you know, talk about the bathing suit dilemma.
Do you want to read that paragraph?
Sure.
In this paragraph, Sarah is shopping with her young daughter, Lucy, and while she's, you know, trying to find a good bathing suit, she also has to keep track of where her daughter is.
That's right. And I should say that Sarah is hoping to go to the town pool and reconnect with Todd after their first intense flirtation. So she's given this a lot of thought. When she finally made her selections, she dragged Lucy into the fitting room and told her to stay put while she tried the suits on over her generously cut gray cotton panties, which kept poking out and spoiling the effect. Not that there was much to spoil. The first suit hugged her hips and waist perfectly, but looked about 3 sizes too big on top. The second fit nicely across her chest, but drooped off her ass like a tote bag. She thought the third suit looked okay. It was a black one-piece, daringly low-cut, with a series of oval cutouts traveling up the side. But when she left the fitting room to consult with the sales lady in front of the three-way mirror, the woman hesitated for a long time before answering. "I wouldn't," she said finally.
Yeah, I Sarah love that. You know, when you know, like when the sales lady who needs to sell you clothes thinks something looks bad, it really looks bad.
I know. Usually, she would.
That was good. Okay. Thanks for reading that. Did you talk with your wife a lot about certain things, you know, before writing the book or while writing the book, just to get, you know, just again to get into a kind of female point of view of things?
I think when you live with somebody, you get their point of view.
Good point.
Kind of around the clock. I'm sure I had to ask her certain questions, and she'd be very happy to help me if I did. But I think it's more like a steady stream of information that I get from her and from other women friends.
You've said that one of your interests is writing in a period that's obsessed with youth culture. And you started writing when you were in your 20s. You started publishing, I should say, yes, when you were in your 20s?
Actually, 30s? I started writing those stories when I was in my 20s, but they didn't get published till I was in my early 30s. Bad haircut.
Has it been difficult for you to make that transition out of youth culture as a writer and as a person, to not be like the young person anymore or the young writer?
No, I just practice denial on an extreme level.
I guess I'm wondering, like, what's your approach to like getting older in a culture that is so kind of youth obsessed and so in denial about getting older?
Well, I think like a lot of people my age, there is that kind of denial. I mean, I know that when my first kid was born, one of the first things I did was get a mountain bike and. Had some period, where I think I take way better care of my body now and spend a lot more time exercising now than I did when I was young. And I was, at least until a couple of years ago, I was the kind of person who, I would still get carded. And, when I'd go take out books from the library at the college where I taught, they'd say, "Oh, you're not a student." But recently I've started to go gray and I don't get that anymore. I'm trying to do it with some combination of, grace and defiance, as for the writing, I mean, I have to say that I'm still a little bit 10 years behind. I mean, I'm in my early 40s, but the characters and little children are in their early 30s. I do think I'm still looking backwards and trying to figure out, what it is that I've gone through. And that seems okay for a writer. To look backwards in that sense.
Well, Tom Perotta, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Tom Perotta's new novel is called Little Children. It's just come out in paperback.
Thank you.
music from the Almodovar film Bad Education, composed by Alberto Iglesias. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews a new German film, Head On. This is Fresh Air. The new German film, Head On, explores the relationship between two troubled young Germans of Turkish descent. Film critic David Edelstein says that when traditional Turkish culture clashes with contemporary Western lifestyle, the result is an edgy love story.
One big attraction of Hollywood movies is watching emotions that in real life would be messy, ugly, and brutal, transformed into the stuff of zany romantic comedy. Two nutty people, a guy and a gal, meet cute, act out their anxieties in endearing ways, make each other jealous, and break up. And then the guy comes to his senses and leaps into a taxi and tries to reach the woman before she leaves on the plane or train or bus or boat. This comforting ritual isn't entirely removed from the real world. It's just that what seem like intractable problems of character and circumstance tend to melt away like chocolate in your true love's mouth. The transfixing new German movie Head On adds a dose of strychnine to that bonbon. Directed by the 31-year-old Fatih Akin, it's one part screwball to one part Sid and Nancy, with interludes of Turkish wedding music to really weird you out. It hovers on the outskirts of romantic comedy and even farce before taking a hard swerve into the land of worst-case scenarios. The central couple meets cute. Well, kind of cute. They're both in a hospital after violent suicide attempts. Kavit, played by Birol Ünel, is an unkempt alcoholic druggie who works in a punk club collecting empty glasses and lives in squalor. He deliberately ran his car into a brick wall, head on, of course. Sybil, played by Sybil Kekilli, cut her wrists, but not, Kavit explains helpfully, in the right direction to make her bleed to death. Hearing that, she gazes on him with big dark eyes and sees her liberation. A promiscuous nonconformist from a repressive Turkish family, Sybil thinks she can use Kavit, whose background is also Turkish, to keep that family at bay. She can marry him and keep sleeping around. This is the farce part, the attempt to put one over on Sybil's family, including the brother who punished her wandering ways by breaking her nose. Kavit loathes Turkish culture, but his life is dead-ended. He has nothing better to do. And he takes a weird pleasure in taunting Sybil. He puts his wedding band on his middle finger, and as they dance at the ceremony, whispers crude sexist insults into her ear. When they're ushered into a private room for the customary deflowering, they do lines of cocaine and stare into space. Our comedies have primed us for the pair to fall madly in love, and I'm not saying they don't, but they're almost never in sync. And they're both prone to making wildly self-destructive spectacles of themselves. When Kavit decides Sybil means something to him, he drains a glass of booze, ecstatically smashes it down on the bar, and then pounds the shards with his hand. By the time he hits the dance floor, he's practically hemorrhaging. Head On doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but it keeps you on edge, laughing nervously, appalled and against the odds, enchanted. The writer-director, Akin, uses a traditional Turkish band to signal the start of each new act. They stand in a line by the Bosphorus River before a picture postcard view of Istanbul. And these stylized interludes remind you of the formal Turkish culture that the characters have left behind. They also give the movie some much-needed lift. The actors do, too. Unel's Cavite is handsome but prodigiously unhygienic. He can bathe and comb his hair, but dissolution and chaos leaks from his pores. The voluptuous Sidel Kekeli has a motor that runs at a much faster speed. She takes everything to the edge. That gorgeous, bumpy nose reminds you she's been walloped once and that she's daring the world to wallop her again. Head On is a downer, but it doesn't leave you demolished. There's something tonic about experiencing screwball conventions without the fairy godmother of comedy flying in to wave a wand and dissolve the obstacles. We watch the head-on collision of these two unstable souls and think, I'm glad I wasn't in that wreck.
David Edelstein is the film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tommy Chong of the comic duo Cheech and Chong. They made a career of doing comedy about being stoned. Recently, Chong spent 9 months in prison for distributing drug paraphernalia on the internet. Now he's touring again. Join us for the next Fresh Air.